and it went like.
Hi, everybody. This is Patty Toledo. We are here with Buo's Games Grindset, and today we're going to be talking about design and production. I know you guys already had, like, I hope you guys all listened to all the other podcasts we did, and we talked about visual arts and animation. We talked about programming. We talked about what to expect from when graduating. And now, best for last, of course, like best of this series, where, of course, the podcast continues. But we're going to be talking about being a game producer and being a game designer. And for that, I have our dearest David Westman here with us today. Hi, David.
Hello.
And first of all, please introduce yourself so we know why you are the lovely David Westman.
Okay. Yes, I have been a lifelong gamer, and I wanted to be a game designer. One of my early goals was to be a game designer, but back in the 70s, that really wasn't a thing. And so I kind of gave up that dream and pursued other things. I did finally get my break to get into the game industry. A childhood friend of mine had gotten a job as a tester at LucasArts, and I just asked him to let me know the next time they were hiring. And 15 minutes into the interview, they said, okay, yeah, you're hired, but we got to keep talking for an hour because otherwise it looks bad.
That's a good thing to have, the most relaxed job interview ever.
My friend had given me some coaching, and I knew the game that he was working on was something that was definitely right up my alley. It was a World War II air combat simulator. And so during the interview, I was laying it on thick about all the history I know, and I know all the specs on all the aircraft, and they interrupt me and say, yeah, but that's all great, but we need you to work on Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis. I'm like, oh
no,
that's not really my kind of game. And they're looking at me like, what? Do you want the job or not? They're like, oh no, it's fine, it's fine. Whatever you want me to do. And it was really interesting because as a tester, you get sort of the worm's eye view of game development. You're evaluating every aspect of the game. And if you're curious, then you want to learn more about every aspect of the game and how it's made. And so I thought that was a good foundation for my eventual transition to designer. And I thought that that was going to be at LucasArts because periodically they would offer anyone who was interested, usually from testing or from product support, hey, if you want to join ScumU, Scum University was a script creation utility for Maniac Mansion. That was their internal tool for the graphic adventure games.
That's a great name.
So I'm like, yeah, please, I would definitely like to do that. And the guy in charge, Noah Falstein, said no. He interviewed me and said, but Dave, you don't really like those kind of games. And like, well, I've grown to like them a bit. And so you're just doing this to get your foot in the door. Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah.
So the irony was not too long after that, I did finally get to work on the World War II game. It was Secret Weapons of the Luftwaffe. And I got to meet the project lead on that product was a guy, Larry Holland, who it turned out was an independent. I didn't know that. And once I learned that fact, it's like, oh, well, I want to work for him. I mean, it's great working at LucasArts, but he's the guy making the really cool games. And so I made a big effort to impress him and convince him to hire me on his next project, so I'd be working with him directly as his lead internal tester. And when the game was far enough along, at first I'm setting up a bug tracking database and I'm diving into the lore. And this is something that's I've carried with me my entire career, is I try to become a subject matter expert on whatever the topic of the game is. I like learning new stuff, and if I'm getting paid for it, it's even better. And but then the game got to a state where, okay, we need to start actually testing it, and there's no content because the team at that time was three programmers and two artists and another part-time, half-time artist from LucasArts. And so myself, and I'd convinced him to hire my buddy, are the two testers. And the offer is made, anybody that wants to make content, here's the editor, see what you can do with it. And there was about seven of us, I think, that started making missions. And Dave Maxwell and I proved to be the most prolific and the most proficient at it. So we became the official mission builders on X-Wing.
Nice. And
that was the other thing. It was like, yeah, well, the next game is going to be X-Wing.
That's a big jump as well, from war to...
Yeah. Well, and as a teacher now, I've been teaching since 2008, the idea that we now have university programs to teach game development that didn't exist until, I think, the 90s was when they first started having them around the world.
Yeah. FYI, this is in the United States. If you were in South America, you didn't have until 2010.
Yeah. So, yeah, the industry was created by people who were self-taught. And as
you know, many times also drop out from universities.
Indeed. Larry Holland was, I think, an archaeology major. And I think it was his housemate got a computer, but couldn't really figure out how to do anything with it. And Larry just like couldn't keep his hands off it and had to figure it all out and became this amazing programmer. And I believe what laid the groundwork for me to be successful as a designer was that, as I said earlier, I was a lifelong gamer, but not just any game. I was about 11 when I saw an ad for a World War II Armored Warfare on the Eastern Front game, and no pictures, but it said 300-something pieces, and my 11-year-old brain conjured up an image of 300 little plastic tanks to play with. So, top of my Christmas wish list. And it turned out to be cardboard chits with lots of symbols, like NATO military symbols, and a lot more rules than I'd ever seen in my life. But I was just fascinated, and I had to learn it. Me and my buddy, we spent about 3 months trying to figure out how to play the game because I kept making mistakes. And what was unique about the game compared to every other game I'd ever played was most family games are symmetrical. Everybody has the same goals, the same resources. And this was not that. It was a game called Panzer Blitz, and it had three different map panels that could be rearranged in different layouts, and it had a dozen different scenarios. And those 300 pieces, you used a fraction of those pieces, and the setup would tell you which pieces and what your goal is, and they're different. So, okay, it's asymmetrical. It's not always balanced. And it had a booklet included that had designer notes.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So it's explaining what they're modeling and why they're doing it that way. And that really got my imagination going. And so I started collecting war games.
Which explains why you went to LucasArts to do war games.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then you were in X-Wings. What happened afterwards?
So, 6-7 year crime spree of X-Wing Star Wars games. Did my first multiplayer game with X-Wing versus TIE Fighter. And then we were trying to transition to console development. And we had signed with Microsoft to do something really cool and innovative. But then I got forced out of the company that I helped build after 8 years. And I got really lucky. 10 days later, I'm literally right down the road at another studio, also working on an Xbox launch title. And this one's a boat combat game, which they had originally been shopping around as a Twisted Metal on Water. And Microsoft came along and they had an IP that they wanted to attach to a boat combat engine. And so, hey, your engine looks like it'll work for this. Do you guys mind using our IP?
Ta-da! Yeah.
And yeah, it was a great experience. I really loved that team. It was another project that was using proprietary tools and a proprietary engine. So no manual, no online tutorials, and just figuring it out. But this time I actually had a much bigger say in what the design of the tool was, what features it had, what kind of an interface it had. And I will regret it to my dying day that didn't get further development, because it was the game it turned out to be quite successful, and we were working on a sequel, but that got canceled for business negotiation, contract negotiation reasons. And yeah, it's very sad. The closest thing to it, there was a mode in the game called Blood Ball that was hidden. It was an Easter egg. That years later, there was a game called Rocket League.
Oh.
And I saw it like, holy crap, that's Blood Ball, but on the ground with cars instead of boats. Dang.
Well, it survived somehow, like morphed.
Well, the concept, right? Well, that was something. Because another thing that I worked on at Totally Games, we did, Larry wanted to do something that wasn't flight combat, that wasn't with LucasArts. I mean, it was realizing that strategically we were in a precarious position if that genre fell out of favor or if our relationship with the publisher soured in any way. And it was a map-based strategy game, which I was excited about, but that one also floundered because leadership had no clear vision of what they actually wanted.
That happens too. Yeah. That's true.
I forgot why I went off on that tangent, because there's so many lessons learned from all of these experiences of, you know, things like teamwork and, you know, vision and...
We can do another podcast only about that.
Okay. All right. So continuing this story, I'll speed it up. So after Bloodwake, my career entered a volatile phase. And over the next 8-9 years, I wasn't in one place for more than a year or a year and a half. And that got to be very tiresome, because everything would be going great as far as I knew. And then I'd get called into a meeting and it was, thanks for all your hard work, Dave. Today's your last day. Like, wait, what?
Yeah. Which for Europeans, I think that's a weird concept, because it doesn't happen here, but it happens quite a lot in the United States.
And in most states, they don't even need a reason.
Yep.
One of the last times it happened to me, I was pissed because it was so out of the blue. And I, can you please tell me why? And they refused. I said, no, it's a business decision. We don't have to tell you why. And I'm like, well, I'm going to call bullshit, because I'm going to go be doing interviews now. And they're going to ask me, why did you leave Backbone? And I'm going to say, I don't know. It was a business decision. So I extracted a plausible reason out of them. But I found out later what the real reason was. And that just made me angrier, because it basically boiled down to, I wasn't reading the creative director's mind and doing things his way.
Which also is another thing. But yeah, I want to get to the question.
Real quick then.
Yeah.
Bloodwake, and then Chronicles of Riddick, Escape from Butcher Bay. And I actually moved to Sweden for 5.5 months. And then the currency exchange rate changed my career path. back to the U.S., moved to Illinois to work on the first Saints Row game.
Nice.
Had one of the most frustrating experiences of my career.
Oh, please remind me later that you have to tell us okay. that.
Went back to California, forgot there was one little company called Check Six that shut their doors 6 weeks after hiring me, owing me a month's salary. So net loss for having even taken the job. But I met the guy who I've been currently working with for like the last 10 years on my side project. So that was a silver lining. And then Destineer, I think. Yeah, that was the last studio that I worked at. And we were working on training simulations for the intelligence community. So various alphabet agencies were tasking us with creating training content for them. And that was really interesting. And for the studio, that was really a way to get initial development funded because they had an entertainment product in mind that they were going to build off of that technology.
Nice.
And then I got the turning point was getting laid off out of the blue from that company. And a guy that I had met at GDC who ran the education, games education at University of Advancing Technology had observed me at GDC taking notes at lectures. So he approached me. Seems like an academically inclined fellow. And when he finds out what I've done in my career, he's, oh my God, I love those games. I was actually thinking about leaving teaching to go make games because of your games. Would you consider teaching? And I'm like, yeah, no, I can't afford the pay cut. But then I realized, okay, yeah, you make a good salary when you're employed, but when you're unemployed, you're not. If you kind of balance it all out, it's not as big of a pay cut as I thought. So I went into teaching, and I really enjoyed it. My first teaching experience was not at a good place, though.
Which also happens most of the time.
Yeah. Well, 17 years of industry experience, I knew something about crunch. And, you know, most games have some crunch at some point, usually towards the end. And sometimes it's bad and it lasts for months. My first teaching job was 5 years of crunch.
Wow. Brutal.
It was brutal. They lied to me. They just blatantly lied to me about the workload. And I didn't know any better. And they were totally gaslighting me my first year. Oh, you're a new teacher. New teachers tend to overdo it. You'll figure it out. And then I go to GDC, Education SIG, and I compare notes. And when I describe my workload, it was a meeting, you know, about 15, 20 people. And only time in my life I've seen this actually happen in real life where jaws drop. Like around the table, just jaws drop. And the first thing anybody says is, you should just kill yourself now because you're in a really bad place.
Oh, my God.
It was literally triple the workload of what normal workload would have been. So 50 to 80 hour weeks for 5 years with about 10 days off each year.
Wow. Well, I'm very happy that you're here because it's
way
better workplace, like way better.
Well, that was the thing. I taught at a few other places before coming here, and I'd actually found out about this place back in 2010. I met a lecturer from here at GDC, and he encouraged me to apply. And I was passed over because my programming skills weren't good enough. And at the time, even designers were expected to have some programming skills here. But it was 5 years later when another opportunity arose. And so I quickly applied. Martin Walker, who had worked with me on Bloodwake. So 15 years later, you know, those relationships pay off. And I applied right away and was, oh, sorry, we just filled that position. Like, oh, man, which is another lesson to be learned about timing. But like a month or two later, oh, we actually have another position. So that worked nice. Out. And during the interview, when they explained to me what the plan was, because at that time, it was still a traditional curriculum structure where you sign up for individual classes and you have your individual assignments per class. And they're saying, we're going to move it all to project-based learning. And great, because that's what I was doing when it was basically just me and maybe one or two other lecturers that would get on board with that concept. And then the other thing that really clinched it for me was that all of my colleagues here would have industry experience, which was not always the case in the U.S. schools.
Yeah, and I love that you already sold the program for me in the That's it. Yeah, those are the big things, I think, for most people that come to work here. Yeah, we all come from the industry and we all want to do education the way we know the industry wants, not academic, right?
Well, and game development is such an exciting field for a lot of people that you know, if as a child, if you grow up playing games, it's sort of natural. It's like, you know, it's in generations ago, it was running off to join the circus or running off. I'm starting a band.
Yeah. I'm going to be a rock star.
Yeah. I tried that. Didn't work out. But it did get me my first trip to Europe as a sound man touring with metal bands. So
true.
That worked out well. And my first trip to Holland, and I really enjoyed it here. Where was I going? Oh, I did lose my train of thought.
Yeah. Why people?
Oh, right. The imagination.
The
I want to make
the project base. Yeah.
And, so, and this, when I first started teaching, it was a private for-profit school with low admission standards. Basically, can you get a loan? Come on in. And the problem with that was that you get people that are in love with the idea of making games because they love playing games, and mommy and daddy have told them they have great imaginations. And when they're faced with the reality, well, this is actually hard. I mean, it's technical. There's a lot of different things you have to learn. You have to learn to work with specialists in other areas and make compromises. And a lot of people struggle with that and realize, oh, yeah, I guess this isn't for me. And some people refuse to admit that, even though they're struggling. It's like, no, but my heart's set on this. It's like, but...
But I want to use this as a segue to the... You work with game producers and designers. I have programmers in my head because I talked about them. What is a game producer? What is a game designer? I think a lot of people, when they play games and they love games, they want to do that. They don't really understand what are the variations of the work in it.
And as the industry has evolved, there is a lot more specialization. So...
Let's start with the basics.
A game designer, like when I started, everybody in the studio, because it was a small studio, even the people who were artists and programmers were also considered designers, right? The industry was started by basically self-taught programmers who also did the art, did the design. And so as games got bigger and harder to make by one person, you need more people, and... We started getting more and more specialization. And for me, the designer is the person who is responsible for the player experience, right? So what is the activity that we're going to be doing? What do players do? Why? Why do they do it? How much context do they need, right? Depending on the game genre, it's just, no, it's abstract, it's fun, it doesn't mean anything, it's just, you know, a click fest and make things go boom. Or it's, no, this deep intellectual puzzle and it's got eerie music and there's so many ways of expressing play through software. And so game designers navigate that space, explore the possibilities, work with the artists and the programmers and other designers to actually define exactly what's going to be that experience and then implement it. And I started as what was called a mission builder, which is basically a level designer. And since it was set in space, there's not really any terrain. So it was all about the relationships of the entities of here's NPC craft lying around. There's the player. There's whatever objectives that you give to them, whatever AI you script the behavior of the non-player entities with, and it's thinking about time and distance and rate of fire and all these kinds of variables and a lot of smoke and mirrors to make the player feel like they're in the midst of this giant battle and that they're playing a crucial role in it. And as my career went on and I got more... trying to educate myself about what is a game designer and, you know, reading magazines like Game Developer Magazine, finally getting to go to the Game Development Congress and attend sessions and take notes. And so over time, I started learning about systems design and UI UX design and tools design and audio design and narrative design. That was something that was a big irony because I hated writing.
A designer that hates writing, you have a problem.
Yeah. So I like to make stuff, but I don't like to write. I read a lot. Give me another book to read. I'll learn more, but regurgitating what I know, that doesn't sound appealing to me. And the irony was that I'm good at it. And so my colleague said, well, you're the best writer here, so guess what?
I heard a comparison once that I thought interesting, that somebody told me that the programmers are the skeleton of the body, the designers are the muscles and the organs of it. That's why you have so many variations.
Yeah.
The artists are the skin of the body, the hair, like is
what you see.
And then the producer is the brain that makes the whole thing move. That was a metaphor, yeah. that I thought, I don't think it's actually accurate, but I think it's interesting
it's a useful
to see.
One,
yeah.
Because I think some of the organs should be divided out among all the different specializations.
Yeah. And also, if it's a producer, is not necessarily the brain, because
there's another.
Yeah. Because the brain can die and still the body will walk around without a producer. But that would be. But I thought it was an interesting way of seeing that in the end, you can't have a body without skeleton. You can't have a body without organs. You can't have a body without muscles, and a body without skin would look very ugly, which is the truth, right? Like, you can have really good games,
but without
a proper artist, it will look not very good looking.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It's very true. Very true. And I think getting back to the process of getting to be a designer and be a good designer, because when I first started looking for a school that could teach game design or something related to game development, the closest thing was just programming. So I could go learn programming, but not game programming. It was like business or science. And I went ahead and took some programming classes anyway. And I found that while I could do it, I didn't enjoy it. And so at one point, I got into paint programs and 3D modeling programs just because, hey, that looks cool. It's fun. And so I started playing around with those. I took a 3D modeling course that I completed all of the work in about 5 weeks because I was having such a good time with it. But that wasn't really where my passion was. But I'm really grateful that I took those little side excursions because I believe that really helped me become a better designer, a better member of the team, able to communicate a bit more effectively with the other team. Other people on the team have a shred of street cred with artists and programmers that I'm not completely clueless about what they do.
But that's a good point that you're doing, because that also is a lot of what the producer is.
Mm-hmm.
So what is a game producer?
Now, that's a good question. Because for the first several years of my career, I didn't think much of producers.
Yeah, and I want to do a disclaimer here, because for a very long time in the games industry, very long time, a lot of companies didn't think much of producer. When I started in games, the first thing I heard is like, yeah, no, you don't need a producer. Anyone can produce, right? And it was not uncommon to have one programmer say, I will produce, or a designer saying, I will produce. There wasn't that much of a respect for the role itself. It changed, especially if you are in a really good, really big project. The bigger the project, then the more important a producer becomes, right?
Well, and it was the Bloodwake project where we had a really good producer, and that opened my eyes. It's like, oh, that's what that looks like. I see the value now.
So bearing that producer in mind, what is a game producer?
It's a lot. It varies from company to company, but in my mind, the producer is the person who takes overall responsibility for the project, which means that they have to be more pragmatic about everything, and they're the ones that sometimes have to deliver the bad news that, yeah, we're going to cut some features because we don't have time for that anymore.
Yep.
They're responsible for ensuring that the team is aligned, and that everybody's communicating with each other. And then they're the intermediary between either the head of the studio or more typically with the publisher, and keeping that relationship moving forward in a positive way. And that puts them in a bit of a precarious position at times, because sometimes the stakeholders, the publisher or marketing, somebody is not happy and they're asking for changes that aren't reasonable. And so the producer's in the unenviable position of taking a lot of shit to protect the team. Because that's I think the core of their job is supporting and protecting the team so that they can do what they need to do to make the game.
It's a balancing job.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of companies, they make the mistake of thinking that producers are project managers. And don't get me wrong, some companies have project managers as well. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes you do, like, part of the job of a producer is a project management, is taking care of budgets and schedules and JIRA and everything. It's part of that, but it's not the only thing. And a lot of these things is the balancing job. It's mm-hmm. balancing egos inside of the team, is balancing business focus from other people in the team. It's a mini balls on the air all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And having that opportunity to work with a very good producer and just observe how he interacted with people and how he handled the various challenges that arise. It was awesome, because I think that helped me grow in my leadership skills. And I was never in a producer role while I was working full-time in the industry, but towards the end of that time, I was being asked more and more often, hey, would you consider moving into production? We could use a producer on this project. And I'm like, I like design too much. But on my current project, I have a dual role of senior producer and principal designer.
Now, for the people that are listening that are either indie developers that have been doing that in their backyard and they want to start actually thinking of having a proper education, or people that are just finished high school and they want to, I love games, I want to make games. And I noticed that a lot of people, especially in our open day when they come here to talk, that they don't really know, like, they know programming is the obvious one, art is the obvious one, but when it comes to design and production, they are always like, I'm not a programmer, I'm not an artist, so I must be this one. So I wanted to give them more clarity of what should they expect from what should they expect from the education? When they come here, what should they expect that they are going to be doing in their 4 glorious years studying with us?
The basic outline of the program as it is now, first year is all about building a foundation. So learning the fundamentals of game design, the design cycle, the development cycle. And for the first 3 quarters of that year, you're only learning design.
Excuse me.
And initially, we start off with tabletop game design because it's transparent. There's no black box. You don't need any programmers.
Or artists,
really, yes. And it's fun. It's funny how often I've had students kind of complaining. He's like, I came here to learn how to make video games. What's this crap? But then they get exposed to all kinds of interesting game mechanics and game genres that they'd never even heard of. And they realize, oh, okay, this is actually worthwhile and interesting. And, you know, just one example, very practical outcome of having to write rules for even a simple game and write them very clear and unambiguously so that players play it correctly.
Yep.
It's really hard. And that is perfect training for writing technical design specifications for programmers to implement something.
And it's interesting to think because people, especially this newer generation, because people don't play tabletop games as much as they used to, but video games is actually quite young. Yep. But games is really old.
Yes.
Games have been around since the cave. And it has always, the designer was always the one that would make the communication in a way that everybody can play. So it's interesting. Like I agree that the base of the whole first year, it's very much based on that. How do you, you break down what game design is quite easily when you're breaking down a tabletop game or yeah. even thinking how to create one.
Yeah.
Right.
And then one of the first year exercises is to take a video game and convert it into a board game.
Oh, that's cool.
And yeah. we don't do that every year, but it's one of my favorite design challenges because for some games, especially like typical arcade game like Asteroids, it's what you want to do is capture the feelings, not necessarily the mechanics. And I actually did this exercise at GDC and my group was given Asteroids. And because I was on the team, let's get a hex map. And I'm basically doing a simulation of Asteroids. And it was an accurate simulation, but it was no fun to play at all. And then we threw it out and came up with a dice game that it felt right. And we get people come over, hey, play our game. Here's the rules. And what does this game remind you of? It feels like Asteroids. Like, perfect. That's what we were going for.
Yeah.
along this, we also start off right at the beginning in year one, teaching everybody the basics of Unreal Engine and learning how to do blueprinting so that in the second and third blocks, students are making, recreating a classic arcade game is one of the assignments, and making their own original platformer, but with some interesting constraints on it. And then that's all to prepare them for Block D, which is when they will work with artists and programmers and spend 8 weeks making another game. And it's one of my favorite parts of the education. Each year has this. It's at the end of the year. So going into second year, somewhat a repeat of the structure, but going into more depth, learning more about the specializations and particularly focusing on either system design or level design, because those two are the most marketable skills for entry-level positions.
Yeah, more sought after, known in the market.
And there's just a lot more openings for those roles. But we do introduce kind of the high-level overview and get into some of the basics of UI design and audio design and narrative design, but those aren't given as much support and focus. But we do have our guilds on Fridays. It's like a mini GDC every week.
Mini conference.
Yeah. It's really good because it's largely student-led, some of them, not all of them. And it's like an interest group where, hey, we're all interested in this particular aspect of design or art or programming. And so let's get together every week and share our knowledge. And lecturers participate, sometimes give actual assignments or some practical exercise to learn something. And a lot of it is very much driven by the students who are just really passionate, and the lecturers just kind of
help
out.
Yeah.
And then the second year project, previously it was a 2-block project. I think that last year it was a 1-block. They did something different. I'm not completely clear on exactly what the structure is currently. I know that this is something else that is unique to teaching game development. Is it's constantly changing.
Yep.
We are agile in our teaching because we have to be.
Well, it has to be, because if you think how games changed in the last 3 years, it's ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that I love here the most is that the students are creating games every year. They're creating things that, and we discussed that in other podcasts as well, that first, second year, you go to itch.io. Third year, go in Steam. Fourth year, you can open your own company if you want to, or you can go to an internship. Like, the fact that you are constantly being a game developer,
yeah,
not being just learning theory and hoping that you're going to get a job, and that you're constantly doing that and you're constantly talking with people from the industry, makes it quite unique, but also brings a ton of challenges for new people. So my next question that I want to ask is, what do you think are the biggest challenge that the students have as designers and producers when they come here, from their expectations, from their preparation? Like, you have been here quite a while now. What are the biggest challenges that you have seen over the years?
I think one of them is their expectations, that particularly if they come into the program with some knowledge, some skills, they've maybe made some small games, and they really just want to learn more about the tools and just focus on making the game, and anything that smacks of an academic thing can be a problem, because they'll prioritize making the game over keeping up on their academic reporting and reflection. And the irony is that those academic aspects of the program are not purely academic. They actually reflect industry practice. And they're designed to teach students a frame of mind and an approach to problem solving and to working with others, that I think most people in the industry learn those lessons the hard way. And what we hope to achieve with the way we've structured the program is that we will spare people that pain.
And train them, because in the end, that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
We're training them. I told you that story before, but I haven't told here in the podcast. I taught before, and I had a student once turn to me and say, "Well, we are game developers. Why do I have to write a GDD?" And for the ones who know, a GDD is a game design document, pretty much the Bible that these designers write, so that the artists and the programmers know what they are gonna do next. Like, it's the skeleton of the game. It's really telling them what the game is. Mm-hmm. Not every company writes there. The practice changed over the years, but at that time, it was the thing.
Yeah.
That you wouldn't have a game without the GDD. So in the education, where it was one of the documentation they had to do. But it's pretty much that. People want to go in the nitty-gritty of the practical, but they don't want to sit and do the boring part. It's not boring, but it's different.
It can be hard to see the intrinsic value of doing things like tracking your time.
No, and also, you said that you don't like writing. You understand that. It's not something that is necessarily pleasurable, but it's extremely necessary.
It's extremely necessary, indeed. Yeah.
And you can get good at that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the other thing is over time, and, you know, at each new job, one of the first things I typically would do is, you know, go through the folders on the project drive and recognize a mess and start straightening things up, organizing things, reformatting documents, and just imposing some logical structure to things that, universally, oh, wow, that's amazing. Thanks for doing that. Because people get so focused on what's right in front of them that they will maybe cut corners, or, you know, to, you know, expedite this and just not do the documentation part. And then it bites them in the ass later.
Yep.
Because, well, why has this been changed? Why is this different? What's going on here? Why? And where did I put that? I know I did something on that earlier. I have that problem with my current project with one of my colleagues gets frustrated if he can't find a document. So he'll create a new one. I'm like, dude, we already have, here's the link to the spreadsheet. I've sent it to you three times.
I have to do another podcast with you just for us to do. This morning we talked about what we're going to talk today, and we realized that we would need at least three different podcasts to be able to cover everything. So we're going to do that. But there are two things that I wanted to do for us to finish this one. Two.
Okay.
Because we exploded all the time of everything. We're having too much fun with that. But one of the things is we have to finish with advice for the people getting in.
Mm.
Absolutely. But before that, you have to tell me what was the worst job story that you said that you get to choose. Without throwing people in the fire, let's be politically correct.
Oh, right. Well, so I was hired by Volition to be the lead designer on Saints Row. And it was the highest salary I've ever been paid. And this is after 11 years of making games that have all been successful. And so then to have repeatedly all of the other leads unanimous in their opinion that I was wrong.
Okay.
like
in general, like you were wrong as
all
a
kinds
person.
Of things. Well, yeah, it's like just one
David,
example.
You're wrong.
So we're basically making a GTA clone, but as much as possible, we want to either match or exceed them, you know, feature by feature, quality of those gameplay features. And just for an example, melee combat. In GTA at the time, San Andreas was the latest title. It was lackluster. It was just mash a button and it wasn't very fun. So I proposed, well, we can one-up them on that pretty easily. We could have a basic combo system and make it interesting. And I was told, no, you're too hardcore, Dave. They kept telling me that. And no, just keep it simple. It's like you're trying to put, you know, Street Fighter 2 into the game as just another game mode. I'm like, no, that would be on a scale of 1 to 10. That would be 10. I'm trying to get us to 2.5. And so they decide, no, we're not going to do that. They implement the GTA style.
Mesh, but yeah, of course.
And then it goes to focus testing and universally panned as, this isn't very fun. Oh, gosh, who predicted that? And so they finally come around to implementing something more interesting, but we've lost a month. And that happened over and over again. And one of the first things during the first couple of months that I was there was mostly just wrapping my head around it. It was such an enormous project and they'd never done anything like that before. They were building their own engine and tools. They're going up against Rockstar and they've given themselves way less time because it's supposed to be an Xbox 360 launch title. And the team size is like 3 or 4 times bigger than they've ever managed. And I'm looking at all of this and I reached the conclusion that
this is
insane.
Yeah, this is a disaster.
And I go to tell them, I don't think we're going to be a launch title. If you want a decent game, you're looking at summer release of 2006, not winter 2005. And the response is, well, that's not the attitude we want around here. Okay. And it, at the point where I left, and that was something else I learned, as the lead designer on a very large project with a very large team, you've got a lot of people reporting to you and your job is basically a manager job. So I wasn't feeling fulfilled as a designer. I wasn't getting to create a lot. I was delegating all the fun stuff to other designers. And at the time I left, they were gently nudging people to put in 50, 55 hours a week. And then right after I left, it became mandatory minimum 60 hours a week.
Wow. Only in the United States, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. Yeah. And it turned into a death march. And it was not a launch title. It shipped in August of 2006.
Ta-da! Yeah.
So I emailed the project manager, hey, who was it that predicted that? His reply, it was a very wise man. He doesn't work here anymore.
True. And then to end, please, the advice to the students, our future students, hopefully.
Okay. Make games. Even you don't have to make computer games, although there's tons of software that you can get for free. Unreal Engine, Unity, Game Maker, any of those. We focus on Unreal Engine because that is something that's used by many, many, many AAA studios. But seriously, even if you don't have to make a game from scratch, you can mod things. There's tons of games that have built-in tools or that a big fan community has created tools. In fact, one of the first mission level designers that we hired, he had gotten a job as a product support person at LucasArts, but he really wanted to work on X-Wing games. He and his buddies had hacked their own mission editor. So nice. He was already making missions just for fun. So yeah, come on in. So if you've got that kind of an inclination, that aptitude to figure out how things work and then start playing around, breaking them, making them do different things, you're on your way.
Nice. David, thank you very, very much. We're going to have to do like part two, okay. Three, four.
But yeah, looking forward to it.
This was lovely. Thank you very much. And I see you guys next week. Bye.
Bye. And then it went like...